This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. Welcome to the show, 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 5th of October. I'm Melissa Idris, and I'm going to be staying with you all the way till 10 o'clock today. With me is
Brian Fernandez.
Good morning, Brian. It's Thursday. So every Thursday, we have an episode of our InvestSmart series brought to you by the Securities Commission of Malaysia. And in the previous episode, Brian, that was at 7:55, we had established that investing in stocks requires a lot of homework. So that was basically the 101 when it comes to investing in stocks. In today's episode, we're going to be taking it a step further. So once you've got the basics down, what's next, right? So the idea is to identify an investing strategy that's right for you. So today at 7:55, we're going to have a discussion with we have a discussion with two gentlemen, Singular Asset Management's Teo Kok Lin, who will be sharing some of the strategies to work out what works best for you in terms of stock investing, as well as Lee Kok Kee from Kenanga Investment Bank. So find out more about that. Well, we also have a Twitter poll going at the moment, don't we, Brian?
Yeah, so it's basically about what strategies you should take. Do you take a buy and hold approach? Or do you take a buy low and sell high approach? So please participate in this. That would be a very interesting feedback after we've compiled the list from the poll.
So we'll find out what most people tend to do. Do they invest in stocks for the short term or for the long term? So tell us. You can follow us on Twitter at BFM Radio. But let's kick off the show with a look at some news. Breaking overnight was U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson denying rumors that he had a rift with Donald Trump and that he was about to resign. So he was responding to an NBC report that said he had considered resigning earlier this year after falling out with Donald Trump and that he was, in fact, talked out of resigning by Trump.
Well, again, the dysfunctional Trump administration continues. Nothing new. We look forward to seeing the unfolding drama here again.
Yeah, it was a little unusual for a cabinet secretary to hold an impromptu press conference, but I guess he felt the need to renew his vows of loyalty to the president. Moving on, still in the U.S., there's a mother in the U.S. state of Michigan who has been sentenced to 7 days in jail after refusing a judge's order to have her son vaccinated. So Rebecca Bredeau will not let her 9-year-old be immunized, and this was after agreeing with the father of her son to do so. So they're separated, and as part of that agreement, they said, okay, we're going to vaccinate our child, but she then reneged on that promise, and he took her to court. So the judge said she must vaccinate the child, but she refuses to because immunizing her son goes against her beliefs, she says.
So that's interesting because in Malaysia, there was a controversy earlier this year where parents were worried about vaccinating their children. We don't have laws that compel parents to do that. It's interesting that in the U.S. they do.
They do, yes. However, in Michigan, child immunization rates are among the worst in the nation, ranking 43rd among the 50 U.S. states. We'll be back with more discussion after this, including a look at what the Bank Negara deputy governor said. Millennials have lower financial resilience. Is that true? We'll discuss after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, See My Baby Jive by Wizard. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Brian Fernandez here with me as we take a look at a comment made by Bank Negara Deputy Governor Abdul Rashid Ghaffur. Yesterday at an event, he said Malaysians live for the moment when it comes to spending, and this has resulted in high debt, low financial resilience, that makes them vulnerable to financial shocks. And he says that this tends to be particularly true among the millennial generation. So millennials are more passionate about keeping pace with the latest digital lifestyle. What did you think about that, Brian?
Well, I think he's right. And the figures are quite shocking, where young people seem to be living on high borrowings. 38% rely on personal loans and 47% are engaged in expensive credit card borrowings. And the number of people getting into financial trouble just keeps getting more. The whole of last year, the Credit Counseling and Debt Management Agency dealt with about 3,450 borrowers. January to August this year, that number has already been reached. And most of them are between 20 to 30 years old.
Well, I have to say, okay, so I think that a lot of people are passionate about keeping pace with the latest digital lifestyle, not just limited to millennials. However, perhaps millennials have, you know, because they've just started work, they've just joined the workforce, or perhaps their income is not as high. So perhaps that means they may be living beyond their means, right? So the margin for something happening is very narrow when things do happen. In fact, I do believe that a financial capability and inclusion survey that was conducted last year found that 75% of Malaysians have difficulty raising even 1,000 ringgit in an emergency.
Yeah, and so this is the challenge, because there's a digital, that keeping up with the digital lifestyle.
Do you think that's it? Do you think it's about that? So about buying the latest iPhone?
Yes, exactly. So think about it. If you're a fresh graduate and you're starting on, say, 2,000 ringgit in salary, and you want the latest iPhone 8 or soon to be iPhone 10, that's more than twice your salary.
I don't know. I think that, to be completely honest with you, I don't think that it's just to do with this. I feel that perhaps, you know, young people have a tougher time now coming into the workforce at when the cost of living is high and wages have not gone up all that much. So it's really, I don't think young ones or the millennials tend to spend themselves out of pocket simply by buying new iPhones. It just is tougher now. It's a tougher time now compared to when, say, you know, your generation, Brian, no offense, but, you know, when you came into the workforce several years ago, it's a different time.
No, and I think you're right, because let's just look at starting salaries. Starting salaries haven't moved very much for the last 20 years. So when I came out into the workforce, yes, you know, you'd get a high 1,000 plus to 2,000 as a starting salary.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually not high 1,000, but say anywhere
from
mid-thousands onwards.
1,005 onwards,
but then you could buy an apartment for 150 to 200,000.
Right.
A car was something, you know, you could buy a Proton Saga at that time for actually a similar price, about 30,000 ringgit. So you could fairly quickly, if you saved, you were able to buy those two basic necessities.
Sure.
But overall, I think the level of financial literacy, and this is something that's been pointed out by Bank Negara, which is why Securities Commission, for example, runs the InvestSmart series.
Correct, to educate people about the basics of financial security, right? Or investing your money.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I think young people are a little bit vulnerable to, because they don't have all the financial information at their disposal, because it doesn't interest them enough.
Right.
And so they tend to fall prone to financial scams, which is a big issue right now in Malaysia. It keeps cropping up over and over again. And also the fact that, which is a big worry, we are not saving enough for retirement. And this is not a young person issue. This is people in their 50s. So one of the things that the EPF found is that a retiree would need something in the region of 228,000 just to have sufficient retirement income to be above the poverty line.
Wow.
So that's just the basic.
And the poverty line is 950 for Malaysia, isn't it? For West Malaysia.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the thing is, according to a Khazanah Research Institute report, in the 51 to 55 year range, people only have about 160,000 in their EPFs.
That's a stark difference. If the EPF says 230,000 is needed, but most people only have 160,000, then that's a big
discrepancy. That's a very big gap. And go ahead.
No. Yes, I completely agree with you. I also think that you know, we're very passionate about the idea of financial literacy and, you know, having, you know, achieving personal finance freedom is something that we all dream about. In fact, we have a show every Thursday called Ringgit and Cents. So today on the show, we're going to have Felix Neo, who's a financial planner with Whitman Independent Advisors. And what we want you to do is, if you have any questions about about personal finance, about financial literacy, about achieving financial independence, you can send it to us. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899. And we'll have Felix answer them for you. You can find out the answer to that at 9:30 today on our Ringgit and Sense show. But it's 6:15 now, and after this, we'll take a look at whether or not female leaders really do improve women's lives. More in just a few minutes. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Mr. Brian Adams there, some of 69. I've got a different Mr. Brian in the studio here with me, Mr. Brian Fernandez. I'm Melissa Idris. Good morning. It's 6:21 right now. And would you agree that having more female leaders will inspire young girls and women to join politics? Maybe even take up more leadership roles? Well, sometimes it may not necessarily be true, because sometimes women in current leadership positions struggle to make a difference in a patriarchal system. What do you think, Brian?
Well, the thing is, I think it's very, very important, Melissa, to have women in these sort of positions, because what happens is this: while they may struggle within their peers to make a difference, the impact and influence that they have on greater society is tremendous. Because what it is all about this. If you've shattered that barrier,
that glass ceiling,
ceiling, whatever you may call it, then not only younger women can aspire to that and say, hey, she's done it, I can do it too. But also their parents, who, especially in many societies, patriarchal societies, the focus is on the son. So if then they see that a woman is in a position of authority, their attitudes get changed.
They can dream such for their daughters too, right?
Yes, yeah. Not only dream, but really it expands their own thinking. Okay. Say, hey, actually, maybe I should also give my daughter an equal opportunity as my son.
Well, let's find out more about what it's like here, about the female leadership here in this country. We spoke to Angela Kugathas, the executive director of Empower, which is a women's rights organization. And we asked her what having more women leaders will do for women and girls here in Malaysia.
Well, in Malaysia's context, I do think that having more women leaders will sort of demonstrate possibilities, yeah, for other women and girls in terms of what they're able to aspire to. We have good women leaders, especially in politics, like Kasturi Pato, YB Zuraida, you know. But we need many, many more. And the thing is, we also need to consider Malaysia's context is quite different from other countries like India, for example. In India, where they actually have temporary special measures where they've actually allocated seats for women from local council, village, all the way up to parliament, right? In Malaysia, the context is a little bit different because the framework is sort of changing. We're moving away from the secular framework, and that means that there's a risk that women will always be relegated to just number two rather than number one. If we look at, for example, like other countries where they have women presidents or women prime ministers, it's questionable whether we would ever have a woman prime minister, for example.
Well, there's research that says that the mere existence of women in political roles can be linked with greater equality in everyday life. Now, could that be true here in Malaysia? We asked Angela.
It's possible. It depends on what these leaders say, because if they embrace the current framework, as I had mentioned earlier, like it's a much more patriarchal framework, if they embrace that, they would just be parroting the kinds of barriers that women face, or they would be just reinforcing the kinds of barriers that women face. But if these are women who are not necessarily in politics, but because the space has become political in the sense that there is a lot of moral policing, for example, over the internet in terms of how women express themselves, the views that they have, these spaces become political, right? But these are ordinary women who are expressing their views against sexism, against misogyny, for example, and they face a lot of challenges, and yet they speak out. So similarly, if we have women political leaders who are not afraid to speak out, who are not afraid to make a stand in terms of integrity, in terms of gender equality, going against the kind of gender stereotyping that we do still see in Malaysia today, then I think certainly there would be much promise for Malaysia if we do have more women politicians. Having said that, I still think the numbers do count, and temporary special measures are important, so that we do get to see the potential of women bloom, so to speak.
I like that, the potential of women to bloom. That was Angela Kugathas, Executive Director of women's rights organisation Empower. It's coming up to 6:25 right now. We've got the 6:30 news bulletin in about 5 minutes or so. But first, here's One Headlight by The Wallflowers, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Absolute Beginners by The Jam. 6:40 right now. This is The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez as we take a look at news that Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has announced that it has entered into an agreement to acquire an immediate stake in a truck stop company named Pilot Flying J. So the stake essentially is going to increase further in 2023. It will increase to 80%. So what this means essentially, Brian, is that by investing so much money into Pilot Flying J, Warren Buffett is making a bet that there will be money continue to be spent and to be made on American highways, and he's betting against self-driving cars.
So, well, yes and no, and let me clarify this. So truck stopping, this truck stop company is a U.S. thing where basically they have truck stops where drivers can wait and refuel and so forth. But what the I think it's not so much a bet against self-driving cars and autonomous cars. It's really the fact that he believes that it will take longer to happen than we actually realize. Because some of the projections are very optimistic that you could, I think, as much as 10 million cars by 2020. So I think it's more that than anything else.
Right. So by his own admission, Warren Buffett has made investment mistakes before, but it's interesting that he doesn't appear to be on the self-driving bandwagon. So we spoke to Sammy, to Johan Sammy, who's a principal at Motion Digest Network. Motion Digest is an online portal that focuses on developments in urban transportation. And we asked Johan what he thought about this investment.
I think Warren Buffett, the investment that he's making right now does make sense. First of all, he's probably looking at the e-commerce space where he foresees that there's more trucks running around along the highways of America itself. So definitely there will be a better market for truck stop business. But at the same time, if you look into the autonomous vehicle space, yes, it is a very lucrative space, I would say. There was a previous report about 10 million driverless cars would be on the road by 2020. It's done by Business Insider, actually. And, of course, there is also reports that say that the autonomous vehicle business will be worth $42 billion by 2025. So why would Warren Buffett not jump on this bandwagon? Well, I think that there's a lot of players right now. Last count was around 200 players in the autonomous vehicle development space. I suppose on his part, he's just waiting for the dust to settle and see who's the winners coming up with the best technologies available, and then he'll probably ride on them. I'll probably say that autonomous or not, the truck does need to stop. You're talking about thousands of kilometers, right? The trucks does have to stop, refuel. It does need to have breakdown services and so on and so forth. There will be a lot of support services that's packed to it. So I don't think that's a problem for him to convert the business from just a truck stop to a support services for someone's truck. Knowing Warren Buffett is very careful with his investments, so this is probably one of the directions that he's looking at to make it work for him.
Well, that projection by the Business Insider of 10 million autonomous cars on the road by 2020, well, that sounds like quite an ambitious number, perhaps because it's still autonomous cars are still in its early days. So we asked Johan what he thought about this number, this 10 million number, whether that was a realistic projection.
Well, I do not know how Business Insider come up with that information. I suppose that when you talk about driverless cars, yet 10 million cars anyone can build, because as of now, there are already driverless cars on the road already, but they are in the form of shuttles, but it's not on testing. So it's just a matter of the factory hammering out, you know, or producing these 10 million cars. But the question right now is that who's going to use them, you know? And is there any government or is there any city will allow these driverless cars to be on the road? For example, in Singapore right now, right, they're doing the autonomous car testing at One North. It's the whole business district that's been designed for autonomous cars. Probably the only place that you can sell these cars, or you have autonomous cars today, you can go to Singapore and ask them, hey, you know what, we want to test our cars on the road. Will you allow it? Yes, they will allow you to do so. You know, but it's the controlled environment. So probably you will find that there will be more controlled environment like Singapore and other cities around the world. If you have enough of them, then probably you see more and more of these driverless cars being tested. But to say that right now, if, for example, Ford has produced a driver's car and they start selling off the dealership in KL itself, and if I buy that car, I don't think I'll be able to drive it in KL.
So that was a curious answer, why he thinks that if he bought that car, he wouldn't be able to drive it in KL. We pressed Johan to elaborate.
Because the roads are not, it's not ready for that. You know, there's no fixed width of the road. The lines on the road is not clearly demarcated when it comes to construction areas and also, you know, goes haywire. And I tell you, at this moment, the autonomous technology itself is just not ready for it. There is a learning curve for this autonomous driving. Having said that, you find it in quite a few of the European cities where they are testing out these autonomous shuttles. There's been like, you know, they shuttle 10 to 12 people around an enclosed area. And they're doing a lot of testing, and they'll be very successful. People would have their doubts about getting the bus, you know, without any driver in it. But at the end, I suppose it's just a matter of getting used to it. Having said that, for Malaysia, we do need to have that environment whereby we can actually have this test bed for autonomous cars. So cities like Cyberjaya and Putrajaya would be quite ideal because they're wide roads, they're very nice lanes and turn-offs, you know, directional signs. But the government will have to step in and put in the regulation and the safety law as well, you know, to protect the passengers, to protect the pedestrians and the drivers on the road, so that when certain unpleasant things happen on the road, that necessary parties would be held accountable for it.
That was Johan Semi from Motion Digest Network, an online portal that looks at the latest in urban transport technology. I have to say, I can't imagine a driverless car in the busy roads of Penang. It's 6:46 right now. After this, we're going to look at whether companies should take a stand on socio-political issues. More with The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, coming into Los Angeles by Arlo Guthrie there. I like that line, "Don't touch my bag, Mr. Customs Man." Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Brian Fernandez here with me, 6:51 right now. And in a recent interview, we had Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella saying, talking a little bit about why companies, in his opinion, should be taking a stand on controversial issues, on things like privacy and security and immigration. Increasingly, we are seeing that corporations choosing to take a public stand in support of or in opposition to socio-political issues. If we take a look at some of the issues, for instance, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, his support for same-sex marriage, he made that a core element of Starbucks' business culture. We also have the same same-sex marriage support from Amazon, Ford, and Microsoft. Healthcare reform is supported by Papa John's, Applebee's, and Denny's. And Levi's supports gun control. Hallmark Cards and Ben and Jerry's also support gun control. So there are a lot of brands out there who have come out to take a stand on very divisive issues. But what do you think, Brian? Do you think brands should take a stand?
No, and you know, especially those names that you've mentioned, Melissa, I really think they should. Companies that are global leaders really have a tremendous ability to influence thinking and policy. So one of the things that they have behind them is money. So they have the ability to influence and engage on a political level. And let's use the US, for example. Mm-hmm. It's about engaging lobbyists to lobby the politicians. On the other side of the equation, they have a tremendous PR machine, internal as well as external, that they can pay for to then shape thinking, either by consumers or other stakeholders.
But the problem is, there's a catch-22 here, Brian. When companies do take a stand, there are some customers who will support them, say, okay, this is in line with my worldview, I'm going to support this brand. But companies also risk alienating customers who don't share that same worldview.
So, and you're right, because I think what will happen is this: if they take a worldview that's against the majority of their customers, they're going to lose out financially moving forward. And I think that this is where the delicate balance is. Companies will not take a stand, yeah, which is against the majority of their customers or their internal employees.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's not so much to do with whether or not a CEO believes a certain thing. It's to do with the customer base, you think?
I think it's the CEO's influence is very important, as well as the leadership team. And not only that, not just the leadership, but also how the employees really feel. But whatever influence and decisions that they finally make and the stand that they take, I think financial considerations will have to be taken into consideration. I'm sure they do that.
Especially public listed companies where they have to answer to their shareholders. But I'm wondering, as consumers, us as consumers, do we punish companies that don't take a stand? For instance, if you see a company that has missed an opportunity to take a stand on a sociopolitical issue, would we as consumers punish them?
Well, I've done that before.
Oh, you have?
Yeah,
all
so,
right.
So many years ago, Shell was involved in several controversies in Nigeria. And what happened then is I stopped fueling on Shell and made a conscious decision to go to Petronas.
Okay.
National oil company. This is about 20 years ago. It's something to do with Ken Saro-Wiwa, and that's a different equation. But I'm just one individual. In other countries, I'm sure people are far more activist in terms of the, where they spend their
I'm
money.
I'm curious about Malaysians, whether we will punish companies for not taking a stand. Do we look for kind of moral leadership in business, right? Not just in the political space. All right, well, let's take a look at news coming up at 7 o'clock. That's in less than 5 minutes. But in the meantime, here's Blind Melon with No Rain on BFM 89.9. Good morning. This is the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. It's 7 minutes past 7 o'clock this Thursday morning, the 5th of October. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez this morning to catch you up on all the news as you start your day, including news, more follow-up details on that MACC investigation into the massive case of corruption in public welfare allocations. We spoke about that yesterday, Brian. We've got follow-up details in the papers today. And also on the business front, Bank Negara is to decide by year end if cryptocurrency should be banned. So all that coming up in the 7 o'clock hour on the morning run. But now let's take a look at why Indonesia is mad at us. Once again, Indonesia has accused us of ripping them off. This time it's the Kuda Kepang design, a huge debate now between Malaysia and Indonesia when the costume for Miss Grand Malaysia was revealed to be Kuda Warisan. And Kuda Warisan is also known as Kuda Kepang here in Malaysia. In the Javanese community, Kuda Kepang is known as Kuda Lumping. So it's not the first time that we've been accused by Indonesia of cultural theft. What do you think, Brian, about this allegation?
Well, the thing is, you know, regionally, we have so much of culture and religions that we share with each other. This is not an uncommon thing. We always accuse Singaporeans, for example, of stealing stuff that we
chicken
have.
Rice,
chicken rice, you know, char kway teow and so forth.
So
here's the thing. You know, we should embrace our cohesiveness. I mean, take it as a point of cohesiveness, really, rather than something that we want to just claim for our own. I think I have a completely different view on this.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the reason why there's such sensitivity is because it's not the first time, right? We've heard, we've had these kinds of debates or these kinds of tussles over things like the Rasa Sayang song and things like batik, you know, Malaysian batik versus Indonesian batik. And I think the closer we are, it's like brothers and sisters, you know, there's this
exactly.
kind of sibling rivalry. But the question is, should these cultural elements be exclusive to one country? So we wanted to find out a little bit more about the history of the origins of Kuda Kepang. And we spoke to Pauline Fan, Managing Director of Pusaka, and she shared with us a brief history of Kuda Kepang.
Yes, the Kuda Kepang or Kuda Lumping is a cultural tradition that originates in Java. It's known by different names in different places. In Malaysia, it is known as the Kuda Kepang. In central Java, I think Kuda Lumping, but in other parts of Java, also the Jaran Kepang or the Jatilan. But it's basically a dance that uses woven horses, and there's a group of dancers that sort of act out or enact the story of the Wali Songo. They were actually nine saints who played a very vital role in spreading Islam throughout Java in the 15th and 16th century. They were said to have traveled on horseback to the interiors of Java and actually used cultural traditions such as the Wayang Kulit Purwa, which is a Javanese Wayang Kulit, sort of local art forms to spread the word of Islam. So the Kuda Kepang partly enacts the story of the Wali Songo themselves, but partly also there are other theories that actually say that the Kuda Kepang also enacts kind of anti-colonial struggles of the Javanese against the Dutch. One theory is that it shows the horses that were battling against the Dutch colonials. And another theory is that it's also showing the the cavalry of Dipon Nagoro, who was a Javanese prince who also fought against the Dutch colonial powers. So there's several theories about how it actually originated.
So, you know, that's good to know the origins of Kuda Kepang, because most cultural appropriation arguments are often very shallow. We rarely know the origins or the history of anything we take on. So good of Pauline to give us some background there. But again, is this a fair claim by the Indonesians? And are we Malaysians appropriating their cultural heritage? Here's what Pauline thinks.
Well, the thing is, you can't actually say it is stealing, because the of course, it is originally a Javanese tradition, but the fact is that actually in the entire Nusantara region, I mean, in the Malay archipelago, there has been a lot of migration over the last few centuries. And particularly in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, there was a huge migration of Orang Jawa, of the Javanese, into the Malay Peninsula. I mean, they're now, of course, Malaysians, but they are also still very much Javanese. And so you find, of course, Johor is one of the states in which you find very large Javanese communities, but they also you can also find them in Selangor and in Perak, even Sabah, and other places. I mean, the thing is, with cultural migration and, of course, confluence, it doesn't mean that if you leave one shore and arrive on the other one, you actually leave your cultural traditions behind, particularly if you are in a community that still affirms that identity and still is willing to and insists on actually practicing that tradition. Yeah, it's not Malaysian in the sense that it's not a Malay tradition necessarily, in terms of, but Malay itself is such a constructed term. You know, we also have to understand that the identity of the Malay these days is in many ways a political construction and actually encompasses a very wide group of people. Everyone from the Orang Jawa who have settled here to the Kelantanese, to the Minangkabau, who in Negeri Sembilan. And so this wider term of Malay is, of course, encompassing all of this. But if you look at Javanese culture themselves, the Javanese communities still do practice this culture, especially in Johor. In Johor, you do actually find communities who still very actively practice the Kuda Kepang. And so it is definitely part of the Malaysian landscape. Having said that, of course, I think to claim it as an emblem of Malay identity or Malaysian identity would definitely seem problematic to the Indonesians.
That was Pauline Fan, Managing Director of Pusaka. I liked that, Brian. I think that she gave a really good context as to why we're having this argument and, you know, the kind of background to culture. It's so, I mean, in Asia, we're used to borrowing from each other in so many ways, our clothes, our language, our food, and even our customs, right? So is this really cultural appropriation?
Yeah, so that's exactly what I said. I mean, my thoughts are, it's basically...
It's fluid.
It's so fluid. We're so, you know, through intermarriage, through migration, through adopting of each other's culture, everything has become a mismatch. We should embrace that.
I think the problem here, and according to, this is what, you know, netizens, I'm looking at some of the comments online. The problem is in using Kuda Warisan Kuda Kepang as a national costume, as an emblem for the country. And that's where I think Indonesia may have the biggest problem, because it really doesn't represent the whole country, does it? It's not quite the national costume. And for this particular competition, the Kuda Warisan national costume will be up against 80 other national costumes from all over the world in the Miss Grand International Organization Award.
Or we could take a different approach then and literally embrace this whole diversity and come up with a national costume that's perhaps a mishmash of all our different cultures.
Different things. That could be work for a very talented fashion designer. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.